sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to a special supplemental episode of Roms Over Baghdad that may or may not become a series. We're not sure. We're going to tentatively call it Cops Over Baghdad. I'm here with my dad, who is a retired law enforcement officer of about 25 years.
Yeah, something like that.
And I just want to hear some of his stories, like the stuff that he's encountered, crazy shit he had to deal with. Now, see, you were with the BLM, right?
I was.
Not like the police force?
Yeah.
So can you explain what the difference is? Because I know that, well, I guess I could explain it, but.
Yeah. Well, law enforcement is law enforcement. Just depends on which outfit you end up working with. You know, here in Oregon, it's the state police, and you've got federal and state and county police,
right.
City police, and federal police, basically. And my career, somewhere near 25 years, was spent in the federal sector as a federal officer enforcing,
right.
You know, federal laws.
Yeah.
And there's about, I don't know, 20 or 30 different, maybe more, federal agencies that have police powers. And people are real familiar with such things as the Secret Service, FBI, U.S. Marshal Service, Customs Service, those types of things.
Right.
But there's a whole shopping list of others out there that people know nothing about.
Yeah.
And some of those are the agencies that manage federally owned lands in this country. Forest Service, the National Park Service, Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Right. All of which have a heavy representation around this area.
Right, right. And all of those agencies over the years, and that itself is quite interesting how this all evolved, have their own law enforcement forces because their particular mission is unique. And I did all the traditional law enforcement stuff that a city police officer would do in a rural setting.
Right. Yeah.
Surrounded by people who were in their leisure time,
uh-huh.
in a park setting or a national forest or a BLM setting, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my work wasn't done with instant backup. Most of my work was done by myself in a truck out in the middle of nowhere. Nobody knew where I was. And most of the time, I knew where I was.
Right. But, so you were law enforcement, but your jurisdiction was BLM public lands.
That's correct.
And not like a city.
That's right.
So you were in a big 4x4. What you drove like a Tahoe toward the end.
Yeah.
You drove a Expedition,
yep.
I believe.
Yeah.
And I mean, those things are like heavily modified, right?
Pretty much so. I first started with a 92 Bronco when I started with the BLM back then. And if you recall, that's when we moved to Phoenix, Arizona.
Yep.
And that was a brand new 92 Bronco. And we had just about everything in the world on that thing. You know, roll bars and winches and guns and knives and about everything. Because you find yourself in some pretty interesting predicaments or some potential interesting predicaments. Particularly, no matter where I work, but let's just talk about Arizona, for example. I would be by myself out in the saguaros out there, and I might be the only person in 10 or 20 square miles.
Right.
Something like that.
So you need a lot of...
Need a lot of options.
yeah.
A lot of, because you never know what's going to happen.
Right, exactly, exactly.
You know, if it's 115 degrees out there on a summer day, you might have, you yourself might have medical problems, your vehicle might have problems, you might run into something, some other guy out there who thinks he's the only one in 50 square miles.
Yeah.
He's doing something he shouldn't
no
have
good.
Done.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And then you've got the... That was the before real-time GPS stuff. So you had to know exactly where you were on a map, which is very difficult when you just have a map in your lap and you're trying to figure out where you are. And if you ever had to order up some help, you could count on it being an hour at least, something like that.
Right.
It's interesting how BLM land came into being. That's the Bureau of Land Management, for those of you who don't know. And most of BLM land is west of the Mississippi River. It all started back in the 13 colonies when the nation started expanding westward with Louisiana Purchase and a whole bunch of other treaties with native peoples and or countries. The United States grew from east to west.
Right.
Eventually grew into what it is today.
Yep.
And at one time, everything west of the 13 colonies was public land. And gradually that was chopped up, given away to cities, to railroads, to whatever. And particularly, we're calling from Oregon. So Oregon, when it came into the Union, it was largely public land.
Right.
And the Homestead Act in the early 1900s allowed someone to come out and you could lay claim to, I think it was 300 acres, something like that, half a section of land. And if you lived on it for a certain amount of time and made certain improvements, in other words, you survived and proved it up, as they say, then it became yours. And
right.
So that's when you had all the homesteaders here in Central Oregon that were out here trying to eke a living out of the desert. And they found out in the long run that there wasn't enough precipitation for agriculture.
Yeah.
And gradually, a lot of those homesteads went back. They failed. In other words, they went back into federal ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you end up with, largely, BLM today. Vast expanses of areas that were at one time homesteaded, but at some point went back to the government. I mean,
we're talking vast. We're
vast
talking
areas.
Big.
Like 90% of the state of Nevada.
Yeah, and like all of eastern Oregon.
Yeah,
it's just in huge, there's huge pieces of there.
Huge chunks
plots
of it.
BLM land out
there. Yeah. I think there's more land than the national forests in this country, but there are huge expanses of it. And sometimes you are in a piece that is, you know, 10 miles by 10 miles, and another time you might be in a spot that is 40 acres.
Right.
Standing all by itself.
Yep.
So it's a real hodgepodge of property out there. And in my law enforcement jurisdiction was tied to public lands. In other words, any law enforcement action that I took had to be within the boundaries of public lands,
mm-hmm.
which itself could be interesting because a lot of times you're not sure exactly where you are.
Right, right.
You know? So the BLM has somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 officers, maybe 300 now. I've been retired for 8 years. And at the time when I retired, we had 150 or so uniformed officers for the entire United States and somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 or 60 special agents, which in regular police lingo would call investigators or detectives. And that's a rather small force for all the millions of acres. For example, here in Central Oregon, I had responsibility for 1.6 million acres. And that is a huge chunk of land. It involved parts of 12 counties.
Uh-huh.
And all the issues and politics and problems that went with it. So you've got one or two, very few people out covering vast amounts of ground all by themselves, enforcing federal laws on federal lands. And kind of taking whatever comes your way. My true title was law enforcement ranger.
Right.
Well, the word ranger means all kinds of things to different people. You know, it's a hockey team. It's a branch of the U.S. Army.
Yeah, that's true.
But in a rural setting, in a park-like setting, in a mountainous forest-type setting,
uh-huh.
anybody in a uniform is considered a ranger by the general public.
Yep, that's about, yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if you're emptying the trash cans or you're a law enforcement ranger or whatever you are. If you're wearing a uniform in a public park, state, national, whatever, you're generally called a ranger. All right. So, that given the case, I was a law enforcement ranger, and, my specific job duties, were exactly that. Enforcing federal laws on the public lands. And I'd actually spent long before we moved to Phoenix, I'd spent the first half of my career with the national parks.
Yeah.
And they had all kinds of rangers, too. And it's kind of interesting how all this came about. We look at police forces today, and everybody looks kind of alike. You know, you've got the cars with the light bars and the guns and the tasers and the dogs and all that kind of stuff. So when you say police, you kind of got to figure what you're looking at. The parks and the land management agencies like the BLM, their law enforcement programs haven't been around all that long. The National Park Service, it was created back in 1916, but the first national park was actually before 1900. The first national park was Yellowstone, and the rangers in Yellowstone were actually the army, the cavalry.
Yeah, right.
Okay, they were the ones who enforced the laws. Mm. And over in 1916, the National Park Service was created by Congress, and it became a managing agency for the national parks. And over the years, like particularly during President Teddy Roosevelt's tenure, there were lots of different areas added to the national park system.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I came in 1978, something like that. And at that time, the generalist ranger was the standard. Basically, you did everything. You did firefighting. You'd do emergency medical stuff. You'd do visitor education. You'd do law enforcement. You'd do whatever. And that worked for an awful lot of years up until the early 1970s. The revolution in the 60s, I call it the revolution, the Cultural Revolution. That's when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
That's when the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, and there was a lot of
like
hatred and discontent.
Mid-60s, yeah.
Yeah,
late 60s.
Yeah, yeah. When people started questioning government and its authority and all of that. Well, in 73, something like that, there was actually a riot in Yosemite National Park. And the generalist rangers there had no way to combat that.
Right.
They were no way trained. And yet they were receiving visitors, and all the people in the park were from you know, the San Francisco Bay Area, largely an urban population.
Mm-hmm.
So out of that incident, the National Park Service, which was the first of the three of the between the Park Service, Forest Service, and the BLM, those are the three big land managed agencies. But the Park Service was the first to come out of the box with the quasi law enforcement program, and. The problem was they thought they had an image problem because the National Park Ranger with a gun on his hip just didn't fit it. Everybody knows what Smokey the Bear looks like, and he's not wearing a pistol.
Right.
Okay, so how do we deal with all these urban issues? And there were a lot of people who were very sensitive about exposure to firearms. Today, if you go to a national park, a BLM area, or a Forest Service area, you've got officers, law enforcement officers, who are decked out just like municipal everyday law enforcement officers. They've got tasers and capstan, automatic weapons. They've got the whole nine yards now. But it hasn't always been that way. And I've been around long enough to see the transition. It's really kind of interesting when I think back on it, because you see, in 1978, when I first started, there were only a designated few, people who were, well, everybody was designated to carry a firearm, believe it or not, in the National Park Service. Anybody
yeah.
could, and anybody could arrest anybody.
Wait, really?
Yeah, you didn't have to have authority. Just because you were a ranger, you could arrest anybody.
Shit.
So what happened was when I came in, this had been going on for a while. One of my good friends and my mentor, he'd been in about 5 years longer than I. And when he started, he was given a pistol and a towel. That was his armament. And he says, well, what the hell am I supposed to do with this towel? He says, well, that's what you wrap your pistol in when you put it underneath your seat. Okay. Just in case
what?
You need it. That's no kidding. And then oddly enough, I mean, ironically enough and sadly, very sadly, it wasn't very long after that my friend's boss, was doing a poaching patrol in Point Reyes National Seashore, which is north of San Francisco.
Yeah.
He was doing a poaching patrol alone at dark and got murdered by three X-Men members of the Black Panther Party.
Oh, fuck.
He got killed out there, and I mean, he's just the wrong guy in the wrong place, the wrong time.
By himself.
By himself. And I think it had gotten past the point where he no longer had the pistol in the towel under the seat, but it wasn't far past that point.
Right.
And these instances started cropping up. In other words, we were finding that society was bringing its problems out to the national parks.
Uh-huh.
And so by the time I joined, I never will forget, I joined up, and when I was given my first gun, I was a ranger in Death Valley National Monument,
mm-hmm.
and there was no standardization, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was given a 32 snub nose revolver, a 38 snub nose revolver.
What make?
Smith and Wesson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, six rounds, 38 special.
Oh, okay. Well, duh. Yeah.
Yeah, and a set of handcuffs, and that was it. Oh yeah, I was given a briefcase because that's where I was supposed to carry all my stuff. No kidding.
And you had to look super super official.
Yeah. The gun and the briefcase, that's where it was kept.
Right,
okay?
Right.
Okay. And all the National Park Rangers, whether you're a law enforcement person or not, all wore the same uniform.
Yeah.
Even the maintenance guys had badges on. So you couldn't tell the players without a program back then. And I remember that you could really tell when something was up because the patrol rangers, those guys who just did patrol, they were allowed under certain circumstances, and it varied from park to park. They were allowed in certain circumstances to actually wear your firearm on your hip.
Right. And like you should.
Yeah. Well, we think that now, but believe it or not, the General Park Service management thought that it would offend the visitor that we were wearing weapons. Mm-hmm. So, on evenings, usually holiday evenings after dark, some rangers were allowed to actually display a firearm. Yeah, imagine that. Then you could tell the shit was getting ready to hit the fan or something.
Yeah.
It was like, whoa, the rangers are carrying guns. Man, there must be something up, you know? So at the time, the guys we were carrying were packing 4-inch pistols. They were Model 10 Smith & Wessons with a fixed front sight, and they had stencil on them, U.S. Customs. In other words, they were cast-offs from U.S. Customs.
Right.
And they had fixed front sights, fixed rear sights, and standard wood grips. They give you a holster. So the holster for law enforcement is the loop in it for the belt is for a 2.5-inch wide belt.
Right.
That's what it fits on. Of course, Park Service didn't give you that. You just gave you a regular belt that's like 1.5 inches. Okay, so you had to wear this thing like Barney Fife around. And, you know, Park Service wasn't really with it. If you were in some areas like Yosemite National Park, South Rim of the Grand Canyon, Great Smoky Mountains, where a lot of crime was actually happening, the Rangers were way ahead of the power curve.
Yeah.
In other places like Death Valley, they weren't. Well, by the time when I was in Death Valley, my gun was 38 special in a briefcase with handcuffs. And I could put it on every once in a while too at dark, but it was in a shoulder holster and meant to be worn under your jacket.
Right. And night sights or like night.
Oh, night sights. Forget that shit.
Way in the future still.
Oh, man. Yeah. You almost had to have an act of Congress to bring out your gun.
Oh, man.
Seriously. Because it was believed. I mean, that was the perception of management that, Rangers did not wear guns.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but that's been the case not only in the National Park Service. That's been the case in the Forest Service. It's been the case in many state parks.
Uh-huh.
Many, many state parks have evolved this same way, you know, and to this day, the state of Oregon, from where we're calling, they do not have an armed police force for their state parks other than the state police that occasionally visit, that patrol the parks.
Right.
So they won't have a law enforcement ranger in the state of Oregon, but that's unusual. But
yeah, that sounds unusual.
Yeah. I was also given a shotgun, which I had to keep in the closet. And other parks I worked at, and gradually over time, when I moved to I moved from Death Valley to Whiskeytown National Recreation Area, which is 15 miles east of or west of Redding, California. It's a reservoir park.
Yeah.
It is a recreation area. And the National Park Service started picking up these reservoirs in the 1960s with a big push on public recreation. And so Whiskeytown was one of these places. And so the National Park Service was the only agency around that would had the ability to manage such things. So they ended up with recreation area law enforcement, which is a whole different ballgame and turned out to be where I spent most of my time. But at Whiskeytown, for example, there was a big, and I started there in 1982, there was a big, big deal there with drunk drivers and drunk and disorderly people.
Right.
And so those guys were way ahead of the game when I went there. I mean, they were already in marked units.
Yep.
And they were wearing guns routinely, you know, and it was widely accepted culture in the park. But a few miles away at Lassen National Park, it was a whole different deal.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't see armed rangers at all. Very, very strange. Yeah, strange. So over a period of time, this was years. It took years, and it took many incidents of rangers getting killed or kidnapped or something.
Yep.
Until I think it was, 19, I forget exactly when it was, that they came out. Well, it was probably 19... Well, let's just pick 84, something like that. Up until that time, the manager of every National Park Service area is called the superintendent.
Yep.
He's like God.
Right.
Okay. And up to that time, it was up to every superintendent to make their own defensive equipment policy. All right. So if you had a superintendent who didn't want to see guns, anything, you had a very minimal defensive equipment policy. If you were in an ass-kicking park like Whiskeytown, then you had a pretty robust policy.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so it just depended. It just depended. And I was in parks that, you know, you would get called on the carpet if you wore your gun into the visitor center, which is the bastion of, you know, rangers handing out information to visitors and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
The appearance of rangers walking around with guns, it upset the managers and worried them more than anybody else.
Yeah.
It was almost a phenomenon because it never bothered the public.
Right.
What they were worried about, what they should have been worried about, was who was wearing the gun. That's what they were after.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay? And how the gun was worn, because they were afraid of when you put that thing on, you take on a certain persona, and if you don't have the right personality and skill set to go with it, you can come off as belligerent, as a hard ass,
yep,
as a Nazi, a jackbooted thug, whatever.
Yep.
That's what they were trying to avoid. And largely, they were able to do that, largely. And over a period of time, things changed. I went from, I think, Whiskeytown, and came down to Lake Roosevelt National Recreation Area in central Washington State. And that is the reservoir that's about 150 miles long behind Grand Coulee Dam. And I worked there for 7 years. And usually recreation areas are ass-kicking places because there's a lot of alcohol, speed, fast boats. And the crowd that go to a recreation area is entirely different than that would visit Mount Rainier National Park, I assure you.
Yeah, yep.
So early on, professionally in law enforcement, I grew to like recreation areas because there was a lot of police work to be done there. It seemed like where all the excitement was happening.
Yeah.
And there was less competition because a lot of the true blue national park rangers, they would never consider working at a recreation area.
Yeah,
they would
right,
have
been
right. considered third class duty, right?
Yeah.
But I loved it. I had a great time there. But by the time that I got to Lake Roosevelt, The Rangers were routinely wearing their firearms, and they had cars that actually had light bars on them. Okay, get that? Light
That's
bars.
That's a foreign concept.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And they hadn't graduated to cages yet.
Oh, prisoner cages.
Right, and the shotgun was still in a scabbard in the first it was in the chief ranger's office. Okay, the park's 150 miles long.
Right.
And the chief ranger's office is at one end of it, and that's where the shotgun was kept. The shotgun.
Right.
Okay. So it moved from there. Then it moved into the trunk of the patrol cars in the scabbard.
Oh, man.
Okay. So you'd be driving around all summer long on these dusty roads, and the trunks never are ever airtight. So yeah. You'd go to change a tire, and you'd open it up, and here'd be this dusty scabbard with a 12-gauge in it.
Oh,
and you'd only find it when you went to qualify, you know, once or twice a year.
Were those bags able to keep them clean?
Sort of.
Oh, shit.
But a Remington 870 will work almost under any circumstance.
Yeah.
The point is, it wasn't immediately available when you need it. You know, when things go down, you have to have stuff at a finger's touch.
Uh-huh.
And so you can see the tendency. I mean, the weapons are moving out of briefcases, they're moving out from underneath car seats, out of the chief ranger's office, and actually into vehicles.
Wow.
Yeah. And
finally.
Yeah. And by about 1986 or 87, we had individual markings for law enforcement vehicles as opposed to the rest of the fleet.
Right.
All the National Park Service fleet was a Park Service green. And it didn't matter if you were a maintenance truck or a law enforcement person, you had a Park Service green truck.
Okay. Right.
So Park Service went to white vehicles with a distinctive red stripe, yellow or green reflective
green,
stripe.
Green, yeah.
Okay. And even
and that
there.
Runs, that runs horizontally yeah. around the, yeah.
Yeah. And we put our first prisoner cage in and about created a riot back at headquarters.
Wow.
Yeah. No kidding.
So for the people who are uninitiated, what we are calling a prisoner cage is a big metal and I believe Lexan.
It's a partition.
A partition that goes between the driver and passenger, front passenger seat and the back seat. So from the floor up to, I keep hitting my mic stand. So from the floor up to about, well, probably about right where the headrests start for the front seat.
Yeah.
And then the rest is all Lexan.
Lexan. Yeah.
And that, those are all hard bolted in.
Steel.
I just hit my mic.
Yeah. There were versions, early versions with just screen.
Oh, you know,
you could get your fingers through, but that would be about it. But the bad part about that is you get spit on by the assholes that you pick up.
Right.
So anyway, it turned into an entire Lexan screen, usually, yep. Or at least behind the driver.
And Lexan, people think Lexan of plexiglass. Lexan is fairly bulletproof, depending on how thick it is.
It is.
So you can pound on that shit all you want, and you're not going to break it.
That's right. It just scratches easy, obviously. It's weird.
Yeah.
But, we actually put a prisoner cage in. And
there's also there's also a piece for the back, too.
Well, there
that
is.
It separates that row of seats from the back, which usually has the third row, the back third row, if the truck has one.
Yeah.
The back third row has been removed.
That's right.
For storage purposes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's called the way back.
Yeah.
In like a Tahoe or something like that. Behind the second row of seats is the way back.
Yep.
Sometimes in commercial traffic, there's a seat back there, like a rumble seat in an older car. But usually it's just blank, and that's where you store all your stuff. But the screen back there is just wire. It's a missile screen is what it is.
I think they switched to Lexan.
Yeah, well, they could have.
For the back ones. Because for those who don't know, I worked a couple of summers at a shop that converted these vehicles for government use. So they'd buy them brand new from the dealer, go get all the decals and stuff put on, and then they'd bring them right to our shop to add the light bar, stereo, loudspeakers, what are called wigwags, which make the headlights flash alternating, install, you know, blue and reds in the front grill, alley lights, all that good stuff.
Whatever JFM stuff.
Right.
Just fucking magic stuff that we wanted to install.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at that time, as all this was evolving, the cars were becoming more and more well-equipped, and we were becoming more and more adept at becoming more traditional law enforcement officers. And the reason we were doing that is the district that I was working in, national parks are all chopped up into districts. I was in the one-third of the lake that was closest to the city of Spokane. We're only an hour's drive from Spokane. So we got all the urban traffic. And we had federal authority there, limited federal authority. But the local sheriff, actually the two local sheriffs there, they would deputize us.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay, so we got to enforce state law. And so we could use, if you're a federal guy and you've got to arrest somebody, you have to take them to the federal facility, nearest federal facility, which is in Spokane, which means, you know,
and that can
you're
be a pain in
you're
the
gone
ass
for 3 hours.
Like places like BFE, Oregon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can do more on that. I can do a whole show on that.
Well, that's what I was saying. Because I remember you said you'd had a shitload of stories to tell.
Oh, yeah.
You can curse, too. This is, no worries.
Yeah.
There's an explicit tag on iTunes.
So in this particular deal, the county jail was in the same, was across the street from where you were born and raised.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there in that Davenport. Can I say that?
Yeah, sure. That's
whatever.
Fine.
Davenport, Washington.
That's non-identifying stuff.
And that was the county seat for Lincoln County. And Lincoln County is largely wheat fields and farmers. And it's right adjacent to Spokane County, which is an urban county.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an urban population coming out into Lincoln County to recreate on their standards.
Mm-hmm.
And in Lincoln County, sparsely populated, very conservative, and the judge there was actually a wheat farmer. And he was not a trained lawyer.
Oh, great.
Okay. So
I'm sure that turned out great.
It did turn out great, actually.
Oh, really?
Because he wouldn't put up with any shit at all. And he would always say, boys, bring them in. He says, our jail's never been full yet. And so we were tapped into that local sheriff's department. We were federal officers, but we had state deputy cards. And we were prosecuting everything through state courts there. So we were actually the driving force in the park. And of all the parks in the Pacific Northwest, which included Mount Rainier, Olympic, North Cascades, and a bunch of Crater Lake and a bunch of others,
mm-hmm.
those are large parks, well-named parks, but they were sleeper parks in law enforcement.
Yeah.
If you wanted to get into the real action, you had to come out to the rec area. And some said, we always guessed that, or always joked that a rec area is spelled with a W, you know. Because it was the Park Service's stepchild to have all these people out there, you know, usually
kind of like the rec room at the district office back in.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the true and blue National Park Service Rangers, they had never set foot in a recreation area because, you know, they were always hung up on the Yellowstones and the true gems. Well, for me, recreations areas were the ticket because that's where a lot of the action was. It was a small park, small staff, and you got to do all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not only law enforcement, but you got to do a lot of different things. So anyway, there at Fort Spokane is where I was stationed. We were right across the river. One thing that kept us going was we were right across the river from an Indian reservation, the Spokane Indian Reservation.
Right.
And there was a bridge that connected us to the state highway that went through the reservation, across the bridge, and through the park. And just up the road, on our side of the river, was a store with alcohol, and that was the only place on that part of the reservation where you could get it.
Oh no!
So it's a culturally, it's a sad statement,
right?
But if you've ever read the absolutely true diary of a part-time Indian by Sherman Alexis, I'd encourage your readers to read that because that's written by a Spokane Indian. And okay. It gives you some insight into tribal culture. And you can expand that to tribal cultures all over the place.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, the reservations, let's just say they have their issues. And largely it's not their fault. It's something that's thrust on them by our conquering them, essentially, way back when, taking away their society and giving them monthly stipends. And it's just a mess. Bottom line, what that meant for us is we would get a lot of drunk people, a lot of disorderly people coming across the res, from the res and up to the store to get alcohol.
Right.
And getting in wrecks and fighting with the campers and just on and on and on. And so that was a continued source of law enforcement action for us. But I was there 7 years. And by the time I left there, the shotgun had gone from the trunk. We had the cage. The shotgun had gone from the trunk to underneath the front seats. In other words, it spanned underneath. You'd climb into it. You'd climb over the barrel of the shotgun when you went to sit.
Oh.
Okay, so it's running under your knees between you and the front passenger. You know, damned if you could ever show it to the public. Nobody ever wanted that upright shotgun. That'd be too much. That'd be going too far, see? So, and we got real sirens. We had some real communications. We had real equipment. And and we were just transitioning into semi-automatic pistols when we left there.
What models were you guys using?
Well, we were just testing around.
You were just going into it. What do you happen to remember making model?
Well, that was kind of a weird deal. I started, like I said, with a Smith & Wesson 38 model, 38 special model 10, and then it went to a 15. And then we went into 357s. And
these are all revolvers.
Revolvers, correct? Right? Yeah. And when I was there, I was still carrying 357.
Okay.
And the Park Service was trying to transition and figure out what to go to with an auto loader, you know. And one of the things that drove that decision was the incident in Miami with the FBI agents getting killed, being outgunned by the druggies down there.
Oh, now, yeah. There was a big shootout outside of a bank or something?
Yeah. There's one of those in L.A. later.
Yep.
But this was earlier. This was in Miami. And as a result of that, the FBI all went to Model 10 Smith & Wessons.
Yep.
And so there was this general trend nationwide for police officers to go to guns that had a lot more ammunition capacity because that's what the opposition was getting too.
And to anybody listening to this right now that wants to check out how absolutely fucking insane those shootouts were, look in the description of this post on our WordPress site, and I will put those links there because they are on YouTube, like the news coverage parts of it. Nothing super raw. So
yeah, a lot was learned from that shootout in Miami.
Yep,
but the agencies are all behind the power curve, especially the land management agencies, because we were so people friendly, supposed to be, and. The odd part about it was the public really didn't give a shit.
Right.
As long as you conducted yourself in a professional manner.
Uh-huh.
If anybody ever bothered to interview the public, they would find out that staying in campgrounds that are unpatrolled scares the hell out of them.
Oh, well, you never understandable.
You never know who's going to come through and who's going to camp next to you. And, you know, I talked to a lot of people that said, you know, hey, thanks for being here. Thanks for being around. And
it doesn't help that you'd likely be outgunned if something went down.
Well, likely. But the point is the public, their perception was different than what the government or the Park Service at that time even thought it might be. They were so worried about being portrayed as jackbooted thugs, you know, that it took a long time to get to the point. They got to the point, I don't know, late 80s, something like that, where they came up with a definition for a law enforcement ranger. Mm-hmm. And it says your basic uniform is the basic National Park Service uniform. However, you will be differentiated from the rest of the National Park Service Rangers by the presence of an equipment belt, which will contain a holstered revolver, handcuffs, a baton, a radio, and a bunch of other stuff. And then all of a sudden, that was how you were being distinguished. It openly said you had to wear that stuff.
So you looked like everybody else, except you were carrying.
Right. Right. You had a gun belt. Okay.
Oh, okay. So there was at least some visible notification that you weren't just
right.
Joe Schmo,
yeah,
park ranger.
By now, you were in a specially marked unit.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and specially trained to deal with these things. And when you got out of the car, people go right to your hip with their eyes, and they know that there's a different tone here than the guy who was emptying the garbage a little while ago. Okay. So that kind of stuff was slowly developing. Ballistic vests, that was another one.
Yep.
Really slow to come about. The Park Service was very slow to provide them. And even myself, I was reticent to wear one just because they were so damn uncomfortable.
Mm.
You know, and much of my time was spent, by that time I was in management, much of my time was spent indoors. And I'd carry my vest in. Well, when I would leave the house there in Davenport, I actually had a little tiny car that I had to drive 23 miles to work in. So
oh, shit.
I didn't wear my gun belt.
Yeah.
Okay, and my vest to work. I put it in this black bag and carried it back and forth, put it on when I got to work. And more often than not, I'd get a little lazy about the vest part.
Yeah.
And get caught with my pants down.
Oh, you know,
all of a sudden an emergency would go down.
Yeah.
And you'd have to stop and put this vest on, and it just didn't work.
Right.
It didn't work. So eventually, I, myself, and others gravitated to the point where the vest was just part of the job.
Right. And know? Since then, like, the technology, I'm guessing, has increased or has progressed enough so where those are a bit thinner and a little bit more comfortable to wear now.
They are.
Yeah.
They are. And if you look around, the Alaska State Troopers were the first ones to modify this, but I think we modeled, in the BLM, we modeled ours after them, and these were external vests. In other words, they were in a Cordura
they were
nylon.
Like marked across the back and stuff.
Yeah, they had a Cordura nylon vest, and your vest panels fit inside of it, and this whole thing, you'd wear it over the top of your uniform.
Right.
Okay. And it had panels on the side that Velcroed, okay, against your rib cage. So when it was hot, you could actually open it up like a bird opens up his wings and get some air circulating underneath you.
That doesn't sound safe.
Well, if you're walking or, I mean, you're in your patrol car or something.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But the BLM started copying that, and now police agencies all over the country are copying that.
Uh-huh.
Not only because it's more comfortable, but because it gets all the weight off of your hips.
Oh, yeah.
Over a period of time, that really screws your back up, carrying all that weight. I think gun belt was something like 18 pounds.
Probably
like
fucks your gait up, too, how you walk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But back to Fort Spokane, when I left there in 92, the shotgun was under the knees in the front seat. There was talk of assault rifles, but that was like poison. You never even bring it up. You never knew.
You never knew
you were going to get that.
Right.
So we were still in revolvers and thinking about going to auto loaders. We were sampling all kinds of them, and we hadn't decided when I left. Now that was an agency that was interesting because they wanted their law enforcement rangers to do a lot of other stuff besides just law enforcement.
Uh-huh.
In most places they did.
Right.
And they weren't very trusting of their employees, and they wanted a very positive image to the public. And so that's why it was so difficult to get those guns out in plain sight.
Yep.
You know? And this is the difference. I transferred to the Bureau of Land Management Law Enforcement in 1992. And in the National Park Service, to be a successful ranger and climb the career ladder, you not only had to do law enforcement, but you had to be proficient in search and rescue, firefighting, emergency medical stuff, and depending on where you were, scuba diving, be a pilot, on and on and on and on and on. So he had to acquire all the, acquire all these skills. And I couldn't keep it up. By 1988, you and your sister had been born. We owned a house in town, and I had other stuff to do. I couldn't keep all these skills up. I was even riding the ambulance in town to keep my EMS skills up to compete. Because if you didn't have all those skills, you weren't going anywhere.
That's crazy.
In the Park Service.
And you had to be like a jack of all trades.
You had to be.
Or like a master of all trades, rather.
Yeah, yeah, and you had to be because you were the only help anybody was going to get.
Yeah.
You know? Because
they hadn't really, I'm guessing, implemented like partner system yet.
No.
No.
No. You were the, by in most places, the only help anybody was ever going to get for hours.
Oh, great.
And so depending on what park you had to, you were in, if you were in a real remote place, you would be heavily invested in emergency medical training.
Uh-huh.
Almost to the paramedic and maybe to including the paramedic level. Like in the south rim of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Or firefighting, if that's a big deal. There's a whole array of qualifications that you had to maintain to advance.
Uh-huh.
And the window was very, very narrow.
Yeah.
Very, very narrow. It was almost like an hourglass. And I was in the bottom of the hourglass trying to get out, trying to get to the promotion. When you're first into the National Park Service, it was an ideal dream for me. I wanted to be a National Park Ranger since I was 12. And so my entire school year.
So how did that become like, I know, cause like little kids want to be like firemen.
Yeah.
And police officers and doctors, but that seems a little specific for 12 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. It was right around there. I was in junior high.
I'm asking like, what was the drive behind that? What made you want to do that occupation?
Combination of things. My father was a police officer, but he and my mom separated and divorced shortly after I was born.
Right.
There was a little bit of that, but somehow when I was very young, I grew adept at, I mean, I just fell in love with sirens, right? I chased sirens. And when I grew up in Yakima. Back in the day, this was the 1960s and 50s. The volunteer fire departments, that's where we lived in that area served by volunteer fire departments. They had no electronic pagers to call the firemen to the station to tell them where the fire was.
Yeah.
Okay. Nothing like that.
Uh-huh.
What they had was this big horn. All right. And it would go off and they'd go, whoo. To do that cycle 10 times, and we were like 5 blocks from the fire station.
Oh, shit. So it was probably loud as hell.
Well, it was loud, you know, but that was it. So the entertainment was you get on your bicycle and you'd haul ass over there, hang out at the fire station, watch the guys roll in their private vehicles. And the first guy there, I'm not sure how he ever knew, but he would pencil or there was a chalkboard outside, and he would write the address of the fire on it.
Uh-huh.
Get in the fire engine and take off, right? And then all the other guys would come in and look at the board, and they'd go join them. And so we'd look at the address, and we'd take off on our bikes and go see the fire.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, shit, we beat the firemen there.
Kind of like that one night when we were driving. I think we were going to the store or something back when I was living with you guys, and we passed that house that was just on fire.
Oh yeah.
And then we just pulled over and we're just kind of watching it because like I think it was like one fire engine had just showed up.
Yeah. So I had years of chasing those fire engines. That was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And somewhere in there, I also got an interest in ambulance work. I'm not sure where that came from, but I recall though in those days, in the first days when I was in grade school, the only people licensed to carry people in a horizontal position were funeral homes. So they were the ambulances. No kidding. And then they went
really? Like just laying them on their back and transporting them?
Yeah, the only people who were allowed to do that were funeral homes. So they were your first ambulances.
Weird.
And this was in the 1950s.
Weird.
Very weird. And then they went to these big, long Cadillacs, you know, ambulances that you see back in the 60s. And I'd see them screaming all over the place. And my sister lives across the street from an ambulance company. And I go, man, that must be really, really cool. I don't know how I got drawn into this adrenaline junkie stuff, but little by little, I was getting kind of sucked into it.
Yeah.
And in fifth grade, nowadays they have outdoor school around the fifth or the sixth grade, or some emphasis yep. on outdoor programming. Back then, they had a thing called conservation. And I don't know if it was a month or two where we focused our studies on conservation. And we learned all about Smokey the Bear and all these kumbaya songs and what trees were and what conservation really was.
Right.
You know, which was preserving resources
yep.
for future use. And it highlighted with the day up in the woods where they had all these professional firefighters and people, foresters and stuff. And I got hooked on conservation. So I wanted to be outdoors. Tree identification, all that kind of stuff. And then I was a young teenager. We used to do a lot of camping, and my parents took us. We discovered Mount Rainier National Park, which was 70 miles from where we lived. And
wait, what do you mean you discovered it?
My parents, we usually stayed in Forest Service campgrounds, but the friends of theirs told them about Mount Rainier National Park, and there's these great campgrounds.
Oh, okay. So there. It was a discovery for you,
yeah.
Not like,
yeah.
Hey, we discovered Oregon.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Okay.
Just, so we go to these clarifying. Places. It's a Hanapakosh campground is what it was, and it was a Class A campground. I mean, it had, instead of pit toilets, it had running water.
No shit.
Yeah. Yeah, good. And they called them comfort stations. That was the damnedest thing. Anywhere in a national park today, they call those bathrooms comfort stations still. But anyway, they had nice campgrounds, they had paved roads, and they had these programs in the amphitheaters in the evening where you'd go and the ranger would stand up there and give you a slideshow.
Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah.
Because we used to go camping a lot at those campgrounds.
Yeah.
We'd go watch them. They're called like camp programs or
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah, yeah, evening programs.
Yep.
So they had this really nice amphitheater, and I sat there once, and here come this guy come out there, and he had this flat hat on and this uniform. And I go, holy shit, that's what I want to do.
What is a flat hat?
Oh, it's a flat hat. Drill instructors wear them in the military, but the brim is much wider. Smokey the Bear wears one. They call them flat hats.
It's more like a shorter cap.
It's
more like a military kind of cap sort of thing.
Yeah, the top of it looks like the head of a Phillips screwdriver. It has four dents in it. Okay. If you've ever seen Royal Canadian Mounted Police, okay, they got that cap and it's got a big round broad brim on it. Flat brim. State police frequently wear them. Particularly,
yep.
I know in Washington and Oregon they wear them all over the country.
Yep, state police here.
Yeah. Those are called flat hats.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool.
And he was wearing a flat hat and I just became in love with that image. You know, and I started watching what they were doing around the campground, and they got to do firefighting and they got to do law enforcement and all this kind of stuff.
Did you do any firefighting?
Yeah, eventually.
Oh wow.
I did. And so somewhere in there I got enamored with, you know, I want to be a national park ranger because of all those things kind of coming together. And I knew that somewhere around age 12, 13, somewhere in there. I recall it being junior high.
Uh-huh.
And I come from a largely, blue-collar family, you know. No expectations, really. No, I mean, no expectations, but no one had ever been past high school. And for me to go past that, that was like a glass ceiling for me.
Yep.
And many others, as it turns out. But rest of my family, I had four brothers and a sister, and they were, you know, when you get out of high school, then you're on your own, kind of, and go make your own life.
Yep.
Good luck, kind of thing. And they would end up working in the mills or in construction or whatever it is they worked on. But I was the only one in the family that says, you know what? I want to do that.
There you go.
Right there. And that was my compass bearing all the way through college and way on into the first 15 years of my career. That's
okay.
What I wanted to become. So this is like a dream come true for me.
Cool.
First time I put on a flat hat, I felt like I was like Darth Vader or something. It's like, holy shit, I finally made it.
So we're coming up on about an hour. Do you want to take a quick break?
Sure.
Refill your water or whatever?
Yeah, we can take a quick break.
Okay. All right, and we're back. Let's see what we're talking about. We're talking about flat hats.
We were talking about flat hats and the uniform and how enamored I was by that whole image of being a national park ranger. And don't get me wrong, that's a great agency to work for. And they've got some, it's one of the most professional agencies in the government. And it was heartbreaking for me to have to leave them, but kind of interesting though how that happened. I was so enamored by the outfit that through the first few years I was living the dream.
Yeah.
Usually these parks are in remote areas, so you live in park housing. In Death Valley National Monument, for example, we had probably a dozen Park Service employees and probably a dozen concession employees.
Yeah.
Those would be the people who sold hot dogs and gasoline and whatever, you know. And we lived in a tight-knit community at Scotty's Castle, and we were 60 miles from the nearest telephone.
Oh, shit.
And we,
what year was this?
This was 1979 and 80.
Oh, fuck.
Okay. This is no kidding. There were 24, 30 of us, whatever.
You guys using bag phones?
No. No. There was no such thing as a bag phone back
then.
Oh,
yeah. Bag phones were like the 80s.
We worked there. People came to us. Scotty's Castle, for those of you who don't know it, it's kind of like a small William Randolph Hearst castle in San Simeon, California, but it's located in Death Valley.
It's pretty cool, too.
It has a fantastic story behind it. So we would get thousands of people come during the day, but they couldn't stay there at night, so they'd all leave. And so the staff up there, when you're working there, logistics were like a nightmare. If you wanted to go to the grocery store, it was 140 miles one way and 175 to Las Vegas the other.
Shit.
Okay. And if you wanted to make a phone call, a real phone call, it was 60 miles down to Furnace Creek Park headquarters. The mail was 60 miles
down
to Park headquarters. And so you kind of had to make up your own entertainment. And, of course, there was no television out there. Zippo. Satellite television hadn't been invented yet.
Right.
Or at least hadn't reached there.
Yeah.
And there were four telephones, actually. There were three up at the castle and one 3 miles down the road where we all lived in a place called Grapevine Village. And they were telephones, but not telephones like you know. These were toll telephones. And you would pick up the receiver if you were at one of these places. You'd pick up the receiver, and there's no dial tone there, right? And you'd click the hangy uppy thing, click, 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 click. And
wait, are you talking about just a payphone?
Yeah, it's a payphone.
Oh, okay.
I think it might even have been a digital phone. No, it wasn't. It had no numbers on it.
Our demographic is like 18 to 20 something.
So yeah.
They'll know what payphone is.
Yeah, it's like a payphone booth.
Yeah.
Anyway, you pick this thing up, and if it was working, there'd be an operator in San Bernardino, California, who would say, "Toll operator, how can I help you?" I mean, this is like Andy Griffith's days, right? And you would say, "I need to be connected with so-and-so and such," and then they would call out, you know? And it's a four-party line so everybody could hear you. And if you wanted to call in, you had to have a certain number to that toll operator. And then you would say, "Could you please ring Scotty's Castle number one?" And they would physically push a button that would ring those four phones. And somebody would pick it up and say, "Hello." But it was a radio telephone is what it was. And it only works sometimes. So, you know, if you want to make a phone call and you were going to go to Furnace Creek.
Yeah.
You know, if you wanted anything, all you went to Furnace Creek. So it was kind of like MASH in many respects, that television show. You had to make up your own entertainment. And so there was a great camaraderie amongst the Park Service. That was one of the reasons. You got to live in some really cool places. I got to actually live in the castle for 6 months as a security officer.
Nice.
Yeah. And right when I met your mother, we were living in a historical farmhouse in Whiskeytown for a couple of years. And you get to really live in some really neat places. Trouble was that you were in a remote place, and the only people you socialized with were the people you worked with.
Yeah.
Which means your boss, like, lived next door. And
no thanks.
Well, it's just something. It becomes the Park Service family. They're very big on that because
right.
of those isolated places. And you grow very close to the people that you work with.
Yep.
But in a way, you become kind of like a cult in many ways, because after a while, the only thing you're talking about is Park Service at these functions, whether it's a potluck or whatever it is. You know, you're talking Park Service. And
Oh, boy.
Well, when you're early in your career, you're hanging around the pager, hanging around the radio, waiting for the next great traffic accident or some damn thing to happen.
Yeah,
you know, because you've dreamed about this for years,
uh-huh.
you know. And so what happened was we moved from Whiskeytown in government housing to Lake Roosevelt, and we had an opportunity. We lived in the park for a while, but we had an opportunity to buy a house in a town about 23 miles away. And so we did that. We actually bought a house. Most National Park Service employees do not own houses.
Right, because they just live on, what is it, just government housing?
Yeah, required occupancy.
Yeah.
That's cheap rent, but there's no equity building. That's the problem.
Right,
a lot of them find out.
Yeah.
So anyway, bought this house, and I didn't realize what a change it would be, but what I found was that it was 30-minute drive to work, 30-minute back. And when I got to this town where my house was, which we were busy filling with children, including you and your sister, okay, which was added responsibilities. You had a house to take care of now, and you were in a town that were just regular people. They weren't Park Service anymore. So you discovered that there were two different, very different worlds.
Right.
One being the Park Service, and this other one, regular people. And it became, for me, I was juggling all these different skill sets, trying to stay proficient, taking IV classes and advanced medical classes and firefighting classes and law enforcement classes, yada, yada, yada. Try to stay competitive for the next branch, for the next career jump.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
And that doesn't work when you got a place at home.
Yep.
A house to keep up, family to take care of. And a regular place where you look back over your shoulder where you just came from, and it's a little weird out there.
Yeah.
You know? So my enthusiasm with the Park Service was starting to wane a bit. You know, the job was becoming more or less a regular job. And the National Park Service then, and probably still today, I can't guarantee this, but they have a reputation for not treating their employees well.
Oh, great. Great.
It comes a couple things that are driving that. One, the first rangers were the cavalry. All right. So the Park Service has maintained this military chain of command throughout its entire life. And so there's that, you know. And so there is a chain of command to follow. It's pseudo military, but still pretty strict. You had to do everything perfectly in your skills, and always requiring new skill sets to be ready for the next job and be better than the next guy in order to get in.
Right.
You had to do all of that stuff. You had to do everything perfect and whistle while you worked kind of thing.
Oh, man.
And for pay grades, they're traditionally one or two grades lower than the Forest Service and other agencies for the same job.
Oh, man.
Okay, and I thought, and I still believe the reason is that they had more than enough people who wanted to do those jobs, that if you didn't like it, pass on, man. There's other people standing behind you. And
yeah,
there
exactly.
were. There were. It took me 3 years just to get a seasonal job with this outfit.
Oh, shit.
So they had a bunch of things working for them. And like I said, there's some marvelous people working in the Park Service and great people, professionals. But the culture of the organization really micromanages you.
Yeah.
And they do not, they didn't want to give the employees the room they needed to be employees. All right. Everything's tightly controlled. Your timesheet was reviewed by someone else when you submitted it. All right. You were never given a telephone credit card number. Back in the 80s, when you just had regular phones, you could still get them, credit card numbers that would give you toll-free phones. Okay. But back at the ranger station in BFE, when you made a phone call, a long distance one, you had to log it in by hand.
Oh, okay. Shit.
All right. And, when you went on a trip, it was a pain in the ass because you had to make your own calls on your own phone number and then submit your phone bills back to them. All right. You went to buy something. You went to buy a new tire or some shit like that.
Yeah.
There was a whole hoop to jump through.
Fuck.
Okay. Just minuscule shit. Get your car fixed. We had a GSA, General Services Administration, who takes care of all the government's vehicles, certified and mechanic, they 1 mile away.
They also do like acquisitions and stuff, purchase orders.
They manage the motor pool for the federal government.
Yeah, like lots of major electronics manufacturers and like bulk industrial stuff.
Yeah.
They have GSA discounts.
Right, exactly.
Right, yeah.
Exactly. So we had a GSA approved mechanic less than a mile from the park, from where I worked.
Yeah.
And when we had a park owned vehicle, it had to go to headquarters 70 miles away. So the mechanic there could fix it because the park employed a mechanic. So you ended up doing this shuttle thing, two people in a car, go up there, drop the car off, come back in a week with two more people. You know, you lose all this time going back and forth when you could have just taken it up to this guy and he could have had it done in the afternoon.
Right. Yeah.
There's an
endless
array of that kind of crap. And then, I was trying to decide what I was going to do for my next step in my career. I wanted to be a superintendent originally.
Yeah.
And where you could do all these pieces of National Park Service management. And the longer I was in it, the more I realized that I couldn't compromise my ethics to become a superintendent because more often than not, I found that they were not supporting the people in the field. You'd go out and take a field action, and before you got back to the station, the superintendent or his lackey would be on the line second-guessing you or some crap like that.
Fuck.
So, you know, as time went on, and only it took several years, my stress level was going up. I had responsibilities at home. I had all these things I had to hoops to jump through that were increasingly difficult bureaucratically. And last but not least, we got a new chief ranger in. And when that happens, it's just like the military. You know, they clean out all the existing people and put their own people in there.
Yep.
And, of course, all they can do is, they can't fire you.
Right,
they just make it uncomfortable for you.
Yeah.
So you move out, right? So that happened to me.
Uh-huh.
Basically, I was given, I was in an acting position. I was an acting district ranger for almost a year because my predecessor had moved on. They hadn't filled the job. So I was doing the acting district ranger, which is the head of a district. And great promotion for me, at least temporarily. The new chief ranger came in, hired his lackey, I'll call him for less a better word, and put him in the district ranger position.
Aww. Okay,
I moved out of my office, and this guy had never been a manager. He'd never been a supervisor, didn't know anything about program management at all. I had to literally teach him his job. And a year later, when he's filling out my performance evaluations, he's giving me marginal evaluations.
Oh, shit.
Up to this, which is a kiss of death in the Park Service.
Yeah.
Okay. And they say, okay, well, we can help you along here, Tom. You want to be a criminal investigator. By this time, I decided I wanted to focus in on something.
Right.
I couldn't keep all these other balls in the air.
Yeah,
so I
want
to do law enforcement work.
There's just a ton of shit.
Yeah. So they sent me to criminal investigator school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the deal was, though.
Wait, so this was some office space shit where you got like bad reviews and they changed you to a position that you wanted?
Well, they were going, that was a position that was marketable for me to get rid of me.
Oh, okay.
All right.
So, okay, they sort of office spaced it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sort of. But here's the deal. They say, I got back from criminal investigator school, and now I'm qualified to be a criminal investigator. And there's only so many parks that have them. There are Yosemites and larger parks, and where they have that degree of law enforcement activity. And the deal was, I wasn't competing for those jobs because I'd spent my whole career in smaller parks, recreation areas, God forbid, and other places. I didn't have a big park merit badge.
Right, right.
In other words, that would make me very competitive.
Yep.
You know? So they said, okay, here's the deal. Both the chief ranger and his lackey came from the south rim of the Grand Canyon, which is a big park.
Right.
Okay? That would be a merit badge. That's what it came down to. And they says, we can fit you up and we'll get you a job in the south rim patrol of the Grand Canyon. You know, that'll turn you into a real ranger. That's not what they said, but that's what they were thinking. You know, and give you enough qualifications to get you the hell out of here. Because we want somebody else in your place.
Right.
Okay.
So, when you were patrolling Grand Canyon, did you run into any crazy, nasty shit?
Or? I never went there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was being presented to me as an option.
And by the way, I'm not gonna ask a lot about that grizzly stuff, because even I don't ask you about that.
Oh, that's okay. I can talk about it.
Oh, okay.
It does me good to talk about it anyway. But anyway, that was going to be my option. And at the time, I was in mid-career, which is a GS-9. And that would require...
Now, explain what the GS-9 system is for the uninitiated.
Sure. The GS is a general schedule.
Okay.
And it goes from a 1 all the way to 15. And most of your mid-level managers are 9s.
Yeah.
I started as a 4. And you progress through the ranks going through those different grades. You can get past 15 into the senior executive service in the government, but that was never within my reach.
Right.
Usually superintendents were 15s. That's kind of the top of the food chain.
Right.
And I retired eventually as a GS-12. But I was already a 9, right? And the choice before me was to go to the South Rim, which I'd spent some time at in training, and I would have known that you're back into park housing. Shitty park housing.
Yeah.
Okay. Living back in the Park Service Tribal Council. All right. By this time, I owned my own home.
Okay. Uh-huh.
I had 2 kids that
like
were getting ready.
Paid off?
Well, no. No, oh, okay. I mean, a mortgage, but I had my own place.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You
yeah.
know? And there was not much park culture left for me. I didn't want to go back to that. And I knew that I'd be going to the South Rim Village, and my kids, they were getting ready to go to school. And I says, I'm not going back. I'd have to take a demotion to go back there to get the field skills necessary to compete for this job so they could get rid of me.
Ah, shit.
You know, and I decided, you know what? And they were after blood, too. You know, they were really putting the pressure on me. I was an outstanding employee at all kinds of awards until these 2 guys showed up.
Was this kind of a situation that you hear about, sort of a, not to get political or anything, but you hear about in, like, police departments at big cities where if somebody goes against the norm where they're defying a rule that is they believe is unjust, and the other officers kind of, you know, rally around it to get him kicked out.
Yeah, that's a typical, like, a Serpico thing.
Right.
But it's sort of like that, but it's not just in police departments. Any organization, if a boss wants to get rid of you, they're going to get rid of you. They're going to make you miserable.
Oh, believe me. Okay? I know about that. Minus the miserable part.
Yeah.
But
they're going to figure out some way to get rid of you. And that was this guy's way, through intimidation. So what they didn't know was, independently and on the side, my friend and mentor had joined the BLM for exactly the same reason. he was saw through the bullshit. He had just had 5 more years before me.
Right.
He got
right.
to the point where I'm tired of this crap.
Yeah.
I can't keep all this stuff up, all these expectations for low pay, low chance of advancement. You know, this is just BS. And so I'd been applying for law enforcement jobs with the Bureau of Land Management. Their program was relatively young. Their law enforcement rangers, that's all they did was law enforcement. Okay. They didn't have to do anything else. That was it. And their intake level was the same level I was already at.
Well, there you go.
You know, and turns out they were a much more employee friendly, let's just put it that way, organization.
Laissez-faire.
Well, they're laissez-faire, pretty much.
Not to the extreme, but laid back.
They were laid back.
Cool.
Yeah. And
that was my experience too. I worked a couple of summers during college doing radio work for the Bureau of Land Management, and we went out to a lot of these really, really remote radio towers to do maintenance, and we fixed, you know, radios and shit when the fire crews would get fire retardant dropped on them.
Oh yeah.
And it would just completely fuck their radios up.
Yeah.
Like just stuff like that. We'd install stuff in fleet vehicles.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just seemed really chill. Cause I remember there was a few days where my boss was just gone and he's like, yeah, you can just work on like this and this.
Yeah.
And I knocked those out in like a day. I didn't have anything else to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep, it was a little harder to get things done in the BLM, but at this point my nerves were frazzled. You know, I was shot. I was at the end of my Park Service career, and I was 39 years old.
Oh yeah, shit.
You know, and I was a little short on retirement, and this is my childhood dream, what I wanted to be, and I had an awful hard time letting it go.
Yeah,
awful hard time. Big adjustments to make. And
sometimes that's what you got to do, man.
I finally started applying for BLM jobs anywhere in the country, anywhere I could get one.
Yep.
And we ended up going to Phoenix, Arizona. And I believe you were in kindergarten.
That sounds
a year before kindergarten. Right.
I was in my last year of preschool.
Something like that.
If I remember correctly.
But to give you an idea, I know we're getting ready to close out this session.
Yeah.
Next time we'll talk about... pick up with the BLM and how that goes.
Yeah, I think the BLM, you starting at the BLM is probably a good stopping point for this.
Yeah.
We're going to actually, I have a couple of questions here.
Oh, sure.
They're fairly lighthearted questions, yeah. So we'll go ahead here. Mike Ward asks, favorite cop movies?
Well, my favorite cop movie was, of course, Cops.
Like the TV show?
The TV show.
Yeah, we watched a shitload of that, man. I remember. I remember like every Friday, Saturday
had
night.
Had to be on.
Yeah, we'd all sit down and watch Cops.
Yeah, you know what? Professional police officers, when they watched that, I determined after a while, I recorded those because I used them in training for other rangers.
Yeah.
And in most cases, it shows not to do.
Yeah.
there's many cases that people are, A, playing to the camera. They've got their sunglasses on when they're talking to people. There's a lot of classic tactical mistakes being made there. It all looks very exciting, but if you know what you're looking for and how they should be behaving and doing, a lot of times you can see mistakes.
It's a lot like seeing people holding guns in movies and their fingers are on the trigger.
Yeah.
When they're not aiming at any people.
Yeah.
At people.
Yeah. That kind of stuff.
That it's a small thing, but that's like one of my pet peeves with action movies.
Yeah, you pick up on that.
It's like, take your fucking finger off the trigger. Stop muzzle sweeping all of your friends.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd have to think about a favorite police movie because they're all, well, they're entertainment. You know, they tend to.
Was True Grit technically a police movie? Well, was he like a sheriff or something?
Yeah. You know, they're all Hollywood, you know, and they'll encapsulate an entire adventure in 30 minutes or 2 hours or whatever. And Serpico was one of them, you know, because that's a true life story about a guy who essentially got screwed by standing up against the New York City Police Department.
Right.
And there are probably several others out there that are pretty accurate of what you might run into, things that would kind of make the hair stand up on your back. But if you watch a show like Blue Bloods, you know, that's a common show today. I like watching it. It's entertaining. But, I mean, they go through all kinds of stuff and that would never really happen in a police department. None of that kind of stuff. So yeah. So, yeah, I can't think of right offhand of what that might be. But all the Dirty Harrys and all that kind of stuff, well, a lot of it's just not reality-based, you know?
I can blur your face in that photo if you want.
Oh, that's fine. I don't care.
Okay.
I'm retired.
That's true.
And sons of bitches can't touch me. Plus, I didn't mention any names.
Right.
You know?
And like I said, if in future episodes, like if you need to tell a story and you, it's better just for you just to use their names,
yeah.
I can bleep all of them out.
Okay, that's fine.
So
are you getting questions? Who are you getting questions from?
I'm getting some questions from people on, a lot of fans of the show. Like I put out an announcement saying, hey, we're recording this. I've been teasing this.
Yeah. Oh,
for a while. Said, hey, we're recording. Send me messages for questions that you'd like asked on the show.
Cool. Any other questions out there?
Yeah, we've got two more.
Okay.
This one is from Kelvin McDonald, one of my pretty good friends from college.
Kelvin, how you doing,
What's
buddy?
What's up, Kelvin? Shout out to Kelvin.
Yeah.
I miss you, man. You got to come over here more often. he says, hey, Jakey Poo.
Got to cure him of that.
Yeah.
It must be a Klamath Falls thing.
Well, I mean, he doesn't. He's from Portland.
Yeah.
He lives in Portland now, I believe. One of the most entertaining questions I hear cops answer is when they are asked, has anyone tried to get out of a ticket by flirting, and how did you react?
Oh, geez. Well.
Here we go.
Yeah, I have to think about that one a second. This is, my whole career is like a book I haven't opened in years.
Yeah.
You know? And the table of contents, I haven't looked at that for a long time. But,
okay.
Yeah, that's happened. That has happened. You know? I can't recall specific cases, but I do know, I mean, yeah, especially with Russians for some reason. I can't figure that out. We used to have a down on the Lower Deschutes in the 90s when I was working down there with the rafters, the Russians.
Yeah, for those who don't know, the Lower Deschutes River is a very, very popular place in Oregon for whitewater rafting. So, and it is on BLM land, I believe, correct?
Oh, yeah.
It's a public, there's a public park and stuff, so during the summers, my dad would be down there doing patrols.
Yeah.
Just looking for people boating under the influence.
That's a whole show all on its own.
Yeah, I know. Cause I did a ride along with you on one of those. That was a good time. We'll tackle that one in a later show.
Yeah. I remember a rich guy coming up to me and peeling off $100 bills.
Oh, and I was going to follow up on this. Somebody else asked. I think I wrote it down. Oh, have you ever been offered a bribe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember specifically. I'm sure there are more, if I think about it. But I specifically remember sitting in the ticket office at Scotty's Castle, and the tours were 1 hour, and they were leaving every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And during holiday weekends, the whole town of Los Angeles comes up there. And so the tour waiting time was 5 or 6 hours. Okay, so this guy comes up.
Oh, boy.
You know, and he says, I want to buy two tickets. I says, okay, that's like for the 4 o'clock tour. It was like 10 in the morning. You know, he says, is there any way we can speed that up? And a $100 bill came off of a roll. You know, I says, no, sir. And he said, then peel off another one. You know, is there any other way that you can do that? I go, no, sir. I says, that's just the way it is. He, you know, pocketed his cash and walked away. He had these gold frame glasses. He looked like he was probably from Vegas. I don't know. He looked like, but he was old.
High roller.
Yeah, he was high roller, all right. You know?
I need to get another desk mic stand because I keep hitting this stand.
Yeah. What other questions we got out there on Radio Land?
I believe we have one more here.
Sure.
Let's see. This one comes in from Mary. She's actually one of the one of the crew from our regular show.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for sending this in, Mary, by the way. Let's see. Could you describe any cases that you've had to solve / work on that seem to be out of the realm of your job description?
Oh, man. Well, the job description itself is pretty wide.
Like extracurricular cases, I guess.
Extracurricular.
Like, I would think maybe she's asking, like, is there anything that you've had to work with alongside, like, the FBI or something? Like, alongside.
Oh, I got to do one thing that's kind of cool. This just, there's lots of this stuff. Like I said, my career is like a closed book, and I haven't read the pages for a long time.
There's the U.S. Marshal thing.
Yeah.
You want to tell that?
Yeah. That was kind of cool. There are several ones. One is a protection detail for President Bush. And,
yep.
And the other one was right after 9/11.
Yeah, it was probably 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
After 9/11, because I believe you left in March.
Yeah. Yeah. Right after 9/11, right after the planes hit, of course, there was confusion. And all the airlines were grounded. They had to put air marshals on all the planes.
Yeah.
But guess what? By then, there were hardly any air marshals, okay, which is one reason all these guys got through.
Right.
But anyway, so they started scouring agencies. Remember those 20 or 30 agencies, police agencies in the federal government I was telling you about?
Yeah.
Okay, so they started scouring those agencies for police officers who had top secret background investigations.
Yeah.
Which BLM officers did.
Right.
And so, I mean, within 2 or 3 days, when they were trying to get the airplanes back in the air, people were getting phone calls. And two friends of mine that worked in Oregon who are law enforcement rangers,
yeah,
they picked up their phone first, poor sons of bitches, and they ended up being air marshals for 6 months.
Oh,
you
shit.
You know, they were flying between, like, Miami and Newark for six months. That's what they ended up being. You know, they stepped up and did that. And there were other rangers who had to go, go to Hoover Dam. They had to go to Glen Canyon Dam. All these natural or these big, high-profile targets
mm-hmm.
that people wanted protected. And you had a whole list you could pick from, but you were going. There's no question about it.
Yeah,
and I picked the Interior Building, U.S. Department of Interior Building in Washington, D.C. And the Department of the Interior is the overall agency over the national parks, the Geological Society, the Bureau of Reclamation, Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, yada, yada, yada.
Oh, the good old BIA. Yeah.
Big building, 500-600 people working in there at least.
Yeah.
At least. Okay. And I got called to do protection duty there, which, you know, there's all these people moving in and out. And there's two of you on each door, so you're basically a tripwire.
And that was for the security detail for, like, the Department of the Interior, like the head of it or something, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. Is yeah.
It? Yeah.
One of the positions was outside the Interior's Secretary of Interior's office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Story there was politics. We got sent there, and we'd stand out there. Of course, we're new in town. We don't know any of those people in the building. So anybody comes through, if they don't have a badge, they ain't getting in, right?
Right.
So all these high rollers, including the secretary, who's ninth in row for the presidency, and all of her cronies are moving back and forth like you see on West Wing. You know what I'm saying? You ain't going past me until you show me your badge.
Yeah.
That lasted like 3 days. And then that post was no more.
So if that only lasted 3 days, if I recall correctly, you were gone for like 6 weeks.
Yeah, I was gone a long time.
Yeah. So what happened after that?
Well, you got posted. First of all, we were out of our jurisdiction. You know, my jurisdiction as BLM officers was just basically the public lands.
But if I recall correctly, weren't you made a U.S. Marshal for this?
Yeah.
Does that still hold, or was that revoked after the detail?
I don't know. I still had the paperwork at home. I should look that up. But to go there, you had to have jurisdiction. And since I was a Bureau of Land Management guy, even the Forest Service people, Park Service, whatever, y'all had to be, you know, sworn in as deputy U.S. Marshals.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
So anyway, bottom line was you had stations at entry points all along the building, all around that building, you know, and, whenever the building was open, you had a night shift and a day shift, and you stand in one place for an hour and then go to another place. And, you know, it was basically kind of very weird.
Yeah.
Because, you were just a tripwire. because anybody wanted to get in there, there's no way you could tell who they were.
Right.
They weren't processing bags through a magnetometer or anything like that.
Oh, man.
Okay, that interfered with business.
Yep.
Okay, so, okay, the one, the plane that hit the Pentagon went right over the Department of Interior building. So
oh,
people
shit.
Are kind of freaked out, right?
Yeah.
And standing on the front door, the front doorstep, which is pretty big, of the Interior building, if you looked directly ahead, you could see the runway of Reagan International. And those planes were taking off, coming right at you. And then.
Oh, so you're looking down the runway?
Yeah. No, yeah. You were only like 5 miles from the runway.
You weren't like perpendicular.
No.
To the, oh, okay.
Yeah. And the planes come right at you when they take off and then they veer off.
Oh, you know? Man.
So you get to watch that happen all the time.
Cool.
And there's a diverse culture back there. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
And, I've never been exposed to that culture.
Save your good story.
Yeah.
Save that one for later on. I think that'd be an awesome story.
Sure. Sure. So, you know, it was kind of a freakish deal because you are always, you're bored to tears, but you never know. Because it was,
right,
it was
yeah.
This was February. 9/11 happened in September. And so the nation.
February of 2002.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And the nation was still on pins and needles.
Yep.
And the other.
Iraq war just started.
Yep. Yep. And then, and the other detail was.
I think, right? Didn't we? Yeah, it was.
I don't think we'd started yet.
I think we had troops on the ground in like March of 2002, if that sounds right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that. And the other episode, I wasn't involved in it a lot, but this was when President George W. Bush, he's the younger one, right?
Yeah, J.W. is the older one.
He came to Medford for a forest plan initiative. And my good friend and mentor all these years that I've been mentioning throughout the program, he was a district ranger in Medford. So he had to work with the Secret Service Advanced Detail. The president was going to come and go from point A to point B and do this. And
so
do
are
this.
We talking about?
No, that was that had been.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, and so we were called in. I was like in the third ring of security. It's like a target, right, with concentric circles. I was like in the third ring out in the boonies, and. I got close to the presidential motorcade. I filmed it on my dash cam, you know, but I was never more than half a block away.
Yeah.
That's about as close as I was ever going to get. It's kind of farcical anyway. You know, the president got off and he was right there and he watched everything happen. And they had pieces of paper on the ground where he's supposed to walk. You know, it's all highly scripted stuff.
Right, right.
You know. Get up and say this and go, oh, yeah. But I thought it was kind of interesting.
Got to have the least amount of variables.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was kind of an interesting detail. It was kind of offbeat.
And I think that is our last question for today. I'll check the IRC chat. Oh, I think they have all changed the topic since I posted in there.
Well, we got lots of other stories for future episodes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't got to the actual stories themselves.
I wanted this first episode to be kind of a background.
Yeah.
Like how you got into the BLM.
Yeah.
And
I had a wonderful
maybe have a couple stories.
Sure. I had a wonderful career and took me to places I never thought I'd go to, do things I never thought I'd do.
With the exception of who they replaced you with.
Yeah. Well, there is that.
That's such bullshit.
Yeah. But, yeah, I look back on that and I still do a little law enforcement work on the side, but I'm largely retired. Couldn't ask for more, really. It was a great career. And, boy, do I got stories. I got notebooks at home. Police keep notebooks that record their daily activities hour by hour. And I can find all the stories in there. I just read through and all I see is a name or two and I just start laughing.
Hell yeah, we can do as many of these as you want, man.
Yeah, yeah. Like the guy one time we picked up after a rollover accident. He was coming home drunk after a nightclub. He had a rollover accident and he was unconscious and we were doing a preliminary survey on him and he had a roll of quarters in his crotch under his pants. Okay, and that was a common practice in that area, so that women dancing slow dance was think that he was well equipped and going.
Oh shit, that's pretty funny.
That is funny.
That's a little hard though.
It's a little roll of quarters. Yeah, I don't know if we got any change out of that deal or not.
No pun intended.
It goes on and on and on, man. I can't make this stuff up. Some of this stuff is just out of this world that people get involved in and do, and that I got to see and take part of.
All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up here for the first episode of Cops Over Baghdad.
Yeah, there you go.
So, be sure to send us more emails. You can send us emails at romsbag@gmail.com. That is romsbag@gmail.com. If you want to send in questions for the normal show, add something into the subject line that says, hey, this is for the regular show. Or if you want to ask a question for these episodes, preface your subject line with like Cops Over Baghdad question or something. So I can see it and I'll put them in a list.
Yeah. So next program, we'll start off with my initial experiences in the BLM and how I immediately noticed the contrast from the outfit I just came from.
All right, man. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing that.
Okay. Got a lot of great stories for you.
All right. So we're going to call it. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Jake, for having me. Appreciate
it. Hey, no problem. Expect this to be a multi-part series.
Yeah, kind of like Adam 12 or something.
Yeah,
although
sure.
You guys are all probably too young to know that show. But anyway, we could be the new Blue Bloods. Or Danger Ranger Days or something. I don't know. They used to call us a bunch of things. Pine Swine, Squirrel Herder, Pine Pig. They used to call us all kinds of cool stuff. So anyway, we'll sign off.
Yep, and, we will we'll sign
catch
off.
Catch you next adventure.
Yeah, thank you guys for listening. We will see you next time.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast.